Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community, as Dr. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein. And Christy, it's nice to see you again.
It's great to see you too.
We got a really interesting show today with medical students and one of the leading health services researchers in the United States talking about a program that you really nurtured, the first program, a reform in medical education that gets medical students into the community in underserved care and helps keep them there.
I'm just thrilled today to have the first students be joining us today and to have this conversation with a workforce expert, Dr. Aaron Frayer.
Before the first, we've got some research that matters where we're going to get to talk about the pretty definitive relationship between obesity and prostate cancer.
And we're going to talk about dementia and a lack of diagnosis and some harmful effects from that.
And finally, we're going to talk about opioids or pain medication after knee and hip replacement surgery. And this is a call for caution.
It sure is. Let's talk first about weight. So we're talking about weight and its relationship with aggressive prostate cancer. So we've talked before, Adam, several times about relationship between obesity and various cancers. But this was a study of about 150,000 men from 8 different European countries that were followed, showing a higher body mass index, or that BMI, and their waist circumference, that those, as they followed them over time for 14 years, were associated with an increased risk of aggressive prostate cancer.
Yeah, and it seemed to be kind of a relationship. The higher the body mass index, the larger the waist circumference. At each increased level, there was higher risk for developing this high-grade prostate cancer. And even more so, there was a really high risk for the fatal prostate cancer, again, for every increased level. And given the fact that we really don't have great ways of preventing prostate cancer in terms of early diagnosis, the PSA test, we're not really doing that very much. This suggests that there is a potential one thing one can do, which is to lower one's weight if one's overweight.
Yep. I mean, lots and lots of reasons to do that for your heart and for your risk of cancer, and in this case, for your risk of aggressive prostate cancer.
One thing we don't know is whether, for those who have prostate cancer, would actually weight loss be beneficial. We're studying this right now with endometrial cancer, which we know is has a strong relationship with obesity. We've begun to study this a little bit with breast cancer. So if you are overweight and are obese and you develop these cancers that may be related hormonally to obesity, one really needs to talk with one's doctor, one's oncologist, about whether or not weight loss could be beneficial.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about dementia. So as you know, Adam, there are a lot of patients out there who show signs of probable dementia, but a lot of times the doctor doesn't make a formal diagnosis. And some of this may be because we don't have, for some types of dementia, the not reversible kinds, there aren't necessarily great treatments that will reverse that dementia. So sometimes doctors will sort of talk with families about it and evaluate it over time, but aren't in a hurry to make that diagnosis. That sometimes happens.
It does. And I hear it, you know, from one of my patients that their spouse seems to getting lost a little bit more, but the spouse may not be there, or maybe they're coming in afterwards and maybe we don't have time to talk about it in the context of lots of other things. And so there may be a delay in some of the diagnosis or the testing. And so we know that these people might be kind of developing it. And the question is, which the researchers looked at in the Journal of the American Geriatric Society, are these people who are developing or who are perhaps not diagnosed but yet have dementia, are they doing unsafe activities like driving and cooking and medications compared to people who already have dementia?
Yeah, and the answer is yes. So in the study of over 7,000 people, they found that those who show signs of probable dementia – but don't have a formal diagnosis are nearly twice as likely as people who have the diagnosis to engage in these unsafe activities like driving, cooking, managing their own finances and medications. Whereas if you tell families, okay, they have this diagnosis and tell them early, we may not have like great treatments to reverse it in those cases, but it does alert the family to pay attention to those safety issues that can make a difference in people's lives.
And I think one of the questions this raises, I don't think it answers it, is when is it not okay for someone who's developing dementia to drive or cook or manage finances or manage their own medications? Because that, you don't want to take it away if they still are capable. This research doesn't answer that.
No, we need to do a whole show on that. I'm going to raise that for our executive producer, Daniel, to do it. Or organize a show about these decisions around dementia. They're complicated.
Decision-making and dementia.
That's right. That's the name of the show. Okay. Let's talk about pain medications after joint replacement. So what we know, and we've talked many times on the show, is that there are dangers from opioid pain medications. People get addicted to them. We have alarming rates of people dying related to these pain medications. And so sometimes we have patients on them, they get their knee or hip replacement, which was a part of the cause of their pain. And the question is, what happens later? Do people get off their pain medicines? Do they get started on pain medicines? What happens?
And this is research that was in the journal Pain. That sounds like the appropriate name for the journal. That looked at this very question, looking at almost 600 patients that had knee or hip replacement surgery and looking at them 1, 3, and 6 months after surgery to see whether or not they were still, if they had been on opioid, chronic pain medicine, still on those medicines, and if they hadn't been on chronic opioids, did they actually start them? Because right after you have knee surgery, you're in a lot of pain for a number of weeks, and a lot of those patients, most of them will be on some form of pain therapy, at least initially after the surgery.
Right. So about 30% of the patients were already taking these opioids prior to their joint replacement surgery. And of that 30%, a little more than half of the knee replacement patients and a third of the hip replacement patients were still taking those pain medicines at 6 months after surgery.
Which also means that half of the knee replacement patients and two-thirds of the hip replacement patients were not on opioids after surgery when they started opioids before surgery.
Right.
That's good news.
Yeah, so half to most of them got off the pain medications.
But a lot are still on it for reasons we may not fully understand, like why is there still that much pain? And then a small number, about 8% of the knee replacement and 4% of the hip replacement who weren't on opioids to start with ended up on them. That's not a good thing. Why were they now having the pain that they didn't before? So I think that's a good news, bad news. We've got good work to do. And if they're still on opioids, we should really question why and really try to get them off if we can.
Yeah. And if that's a setting for you, you should definitely talk to your doctor about trying to get off of these pain medicines if possible. That does conclude the Research That Matters portion of our show. We're going to take a short break. But when we come back, Adam and I will be talking with Kyle Melvin, Thane Campbell, Thomas D'Angelo, and Dr. Aaron Freyer about the FIRST program, Acceleration to Service in North Carolina. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Today on Conversations, Christy, we'll be talking with Kyle Melvin, Thane Campbell, Thomas D'Angelo, and Dr. Aaron Freyer about University of North Carolina's FIRST program, Acceleration to Service.
We are so excited to have you, Dr. Freyer, and Thane, and Kyle, and Thomas. Thanks so much for being with us today. Before we talk about the FIRST program, and I'll just put up front, that stands for Fully Integrated Readiness for Service Training. No one remembers that. You just remember FIRST. And this is an accelerated program through UNC School of Medicine to rural and underserved areas in North Carolina. But before we get into those details, let's have you guys just quickly introduce yourself to our listeners. Tell us your name and where you're from, and perhaps, Dr. Freyer, what you do for a living.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here. here. So I'm Erin Freyer. I'm an assistant professor in the Department of Family Medicine and Surgery at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. And I study workforce issues. I'm very engaged right now in trying to understand if we're going to have the health workforce that we need to really face the challenges of a very rapidly changing healthcare system.
And what about you, Thane?
Hi, I'm Thane Campbell. I'm from Fort Wayne, Indiana, originally. Came down 6 years ago to go to Wake Forest University, and then came to UNC School of Medicine.
Kyle?
So my name is Kyle Melvin. I am from a small community outside of Fayetteville called Beaver Dam. Born and raised in North Carolina, came to UNC for undergrad, staying on for medical school, and I guess I'll be staying on for residency now, too.
Great. What about you, Thomas?
I'm Thomas D'Angelo. I'm from Chicago originally. Moved here from St. Louis with my wife. I have two children. My daughter Lily's 3.5. My son Adrian is 6 months. And I worked as a hospice nurse prior to moving here for medical school.
Wow. Got some really diverse experiences. I'm so excited to hear about your experiences and, Dr. Freyer, your expertise about why this program is needed and important for North Carolina and perhaps as a model for the United States.
You know, Dr. Freyer, question for you, and maybe Kyle, you want to chime in on this too. For many of our listeners who live near a city, getting care can be as easy as finding a clinic or going to a nearby health center, but that's not the same experience that many other people have, and particularly many people in North Carolina. Can you set up for our listeners a bit of the picture of what it is and the challenges to get care in underserved communities in rural areas of North Carolina?
Sure, I'd be happy to. First of all, we have two counties in North Carolina that don't even have a primary care physician. You know, on average, the state has about 23 physicians per 10,000 population. But we have a number of counties that have fewer than 5 physicians per 10,000 population. So huge disparities in the number of primary care physicians that we have. Overall, the number of physicians relative to population in North Carolina has been growing. But it has not been growing in our most underserved and rural communities. But it's not just a shortage of primary care physicians. Half of our counties qualify as mental health professional shortage areas. Nearly 1 in 4 counties don't have a general surgeon. And I'm bringing these things up because it's important to look at the whole workforce in our most underserved communities, right? Because family physicians, for example, may not be able to deliver babies if they don't have a general surgeon backup. Or emergency rooms may not be able to take trauma cases if they don't have a general surgery backup. It's possible that internists won't do complex scoping cases in case they perforate. So the workforce, we really have got to monitor it because there are places in North Carolina where we have critical shortages.
Well, and I imagine it's also mental health care. It's very difficult to perhaps practice and take care of your most sickest of sick, those with mental health needs, schizophrenics, if you really don't have access to professionals that you can collaborate with.
Absolutely. We know that we have psychiatry shortages in the state. And in fact, primary care physicians are unable to find referrals for their patients who face mental health issues, but we also have a shortage of child psychiatrists, which is a big issue because in many communities, we have no one to refer our children who actually have psychiatric conditions. So we have a number of issues across North Carolina: general surgery, primary care, psychiatry, multifaceted workforce issues. People can't access the care that they need when they need it.
Now, we know that there are additional medical schools now in North Carolina with the addition of Campbell, and there are larger medical school class sizes. So part of the solution that our state has been using is to increase the number of medical students. Can you explain for us how that helps or doesn't help this situation?
Yes, indeed. I think most people believe, okay, so if we have a physician shortage, let's just open new medical schools or let's increase the number of medical students. But we know that consistently over time, of our 400-plus medical students that graduate every year, only 2 to 3% end up in rural primary care in North Carolina. So over 400 graduates each year, only 2 to 3% will end up in rural primary care. And so just expanding the number of medical school placements is not sufficient. We also know that after medical school, medical students go on to a residency, but our state only retains about 42% of our residents who train in North Carolina. In fact, we're ranked 35th out of 50 in the United States because we retain on average fewer of our residents. But we know if you go to medical school in North Carolina and then you do a residency in North Carolina, 70% of those people will stay in state. And so we need to look across the physician's career trajectory, medical school, residency, and then out into practice. And that's why I'm very excited to be here talking about the FIRST program today.
Well, we should say and acknowledge that this is a new program. We're going to hear about this program. We should also acknowledge that our own Christy Page was instrumental in its founding and its leadership. Way to go, Christy.
Thank you. Thank this, you. We're this, so excited.
This doesn't happen just because people wish it. It happens due to really hard work. But it's also because we have students that obviously are interested. And I wonder, it just each of you can just tell us, how is it that you became interested in a program like FIRST and in this idea of service, and in this case, perhaps serving counties that don't have the access to great care? Thane, do you want to start out?
So when I was in Winston-Salem in school, I spent quite a bit of time at the Community Care Center, which was a clinic that served an underserved population in the city. That was a population that I felt very driven to work with in the future. And I continued to, after school, work with the Latino population in Winston-Salem, specifically at a community center there, mostly working in education, but also tapping into some health needs as well. And so when I heard about the FIRST program, it was a opportunity for me to work with populations that can't necessarily afford the health care that others can, while still not having to worry about loans, because this program does very much tie into loan repayment.
Well, that's important. And What about you, Kyle? I know that you come from Beaver Dam. Maybe not every one of our listeners know where Beaver Dam is located, though it sounds like a place they might like to visit. Tell us a little bit about yourself there.
So there are two kinds of people who grew up in Fayetteville. Either your family's been there for generations or it's a military family. And mine just happens to be my family's been there for generations, and we're about 25, 30 minutes from Fayetteville. So commuting back and forth between home and Fayetteville every day for school, all of these different necessities, it really started to hit me once medical school became the career path that I wanted to go on, that not only was my community suffering from this, but other communities who were even farther out from a large town or city were suffering even more than mine. And if the true goal of helping people, which medical school is my real goal, then that is something that I should try and champion as well. And being from a rural community, I can understand it better and know the nuances of it in order to give back appropriately.
And how about you, Thomas?
For me, there were multiple reasons. One component was I had gone to nursing school in New Orleans after Hurricane Katrina and did an accelerated program where I really saw the benefit of seeing patients while I was training and while I was in school. And then also, as a hospice nurse, I really saw firsthand, even at that late stage of the process, the way a lack of primary care for our rural patients in Missouri and also for our inner city patients really impacted their care, cardiovascular or oncology, and then into even their hospice care, and the huge impact those who did have primary care physicians in terms of their positive outcomes had. So it was really kind of both of those things for me.
Great. Well, this is so exciting for me to have you guys here and to be really talking about your passion and this program. We do need to take a short break, but when we come back, we'll continue talking with our guests, Kyle Melvin, Thane Campbell, Thomas D'Angelo, and Dr. Aaron Freyer about the FIRST program, Acceleration to Service. We'll be right back with Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Stay with us. Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. We've been talking with Dr. Aaron Frayer, as well as Kyle Melvin, Thane Campbell, and Thomas D'Angelo, who are first-year medical students starting their second year at the University of North Carolina, about UNC's FIRST program, Acceleration to Service. Now, FIRST stands for Fully Integrated Readiness for Service Training, which no one will remember. And this is a unique program that accelerates the pipeline into underserved areas of North Carolina. I can explain this well because it's been something we've been working on for some time, funded by the Duke Endowment, which we're grateful for, and lots of good partnerships. But I wonder, Kyle, if perhaps you could explain from your perspective, what is the FIRST program? Why is it unique?
So the FIRST program is basically a 3-3-3 program. So that is 3 years of medical school, 3 years of residency, and then 3 years of working in an underserved community. So not only is this an accelerated program, but it's also an enhanced program as well, in that instead of 4 years of medical school, we're actually going to be finishing up in 3 years.
Wow. So you shave a year off medical school, and presumably that does save some money for a lot of people because medical school is expensive. But because of the enhanced curriculum, you're ready for residency.
And what so far has been enhanced for you? We realize you're only 3 months into the program, but perhaps you could share your patient responsibilities or some element that's been unique and enhanced compared with other students at your level.
What about you, Thomas?
I think it's been night and day in a lot of ways, even in talking to other students in our program who aren't in the program, of just the value of seeing patients regularly at the clinic, seeing things that we're learning about in class, in person with real patients that we're forming relationships with. You can't put a measure on how important that is and how much it enhances our education and better prepares us to be able to see patients on our own.
Yeah, I think it's very indicative. Last week and this week, I'm spending 2 weeks of our summer in the maternal child health floor of the hospital and learning alongside, as someone who just finished their first year, learning alongside third years with attending physicians that I'll be working with through residency, and also with interns who are fantastic teachers because they remember exactly where I am and where they were at this point in their education. So it's been hands-on education from the get-go.
Dr. Frayer, let me ask you a question. This sounds innovative. It sounds novel. We're the 3 years of making medical school and then the 3 years of service clearly and have this continuity and staying in North Carolina. What do we know about attempts at reform of medical education? And then how do we actually – Duke Endowment, we are eternally grateful, as Christy mentions, but can these experiments survive without kind of ongoing grant support? And what do we know about that?
Okay, Adam, a couple questions in there. Let me do my best. So on the first one, I think this is very innovative because it does shave that year off medical school. There's lots of talk nationally about how we can make medical education more efficient. And I think that this program, by having a 3-year accelerated program into residency, does that. I want to mention another incredibly innovative thing about this program is I, as a workforce researcher, view the physician training pipeline as a pipeline, right? And pipelines have leaks. And so we know that it leaks after medical school. We can train you in North Carolina, but you're likely to leave. Or you can train your residency here, but you could leave. But by this program actually stops up the pipeline and actually finds a way to take people early in the pipeline and track them from medical school into residency and then into an underserved community. And so it's incredibly innovative because it looks across the trajectory. So that answers your first question. Your second question.
How do we fund this? Because it sounds like that this does require some significant upfront cost.
I think that's an incredibly important question. And I think one of the things that we're going to be able to show as we evaluate this program is that the return on investment is very high. Let's go back to that leaky pipeline analogy. The state puts a lot of money into medical education every year, and we know, as I mentioned before, that only 2-3% will end up of our physicians who train and do medical school in North Carolina will end up in North Carolina. But you all are in a track that you will end up in North Carolina. Your return on investment for seeing those patients will be very high. And so I think the thing that we have to do is show the value, the return on investment for those dollars to be able to make this a sustainable operation so that it isn't dependent just on grant funding and that we're able to leverage a secure funding source to not only have this program, but to expand it to other specialties, perhaps.
Well, and the other thing to point out is there are at least six and growing rapidly states who have used accelerated medical school programs to help address their state's workforce needs. And so it's not like we're the first person to have tried this. What is unique about this program, about the first program, is that it does link the 3 years of medical school with residency and tied to that underserved service. So that commitment that you have, being the right kinds of students who already have a commitment to North Carolina, a commitment to underserved patients, a commitment to family medicine, and that we're giving you these experiences along the way to really nurture those passions, is unique about this program. So we know that it's made a difference in a smaller scale in other states, and this really has an opportunity to have broader impact. And the other point I wanted to make about the grant funding is we also have tremendous community partnerships for this. So, I mean, this is not just about UNC and not just about the Duke Endowment, although they helped us make it happen for sure, but the North Carolina Academy of Family Physicians has been involved, the Office of Rural Health, extremely involved and committed in helping with loan repayment and helping with support in practice in those last 3 years, UNC Healthcare, Piedmont Health Services, and this community health center network. So we have so many different community people who are committed to this that also really speaks to the sustainability of the program that I'm excited about. I mean, all of us see this as one other, it's not the only answer, but it's one piece of the solution.
Let me ask you, maybe starting with you, Thomas, and then Kyle and Thane. You're several months, a year into medical school. You're early in your careers, but you perhaps, because it's an accelerated, you're in a program where there's expectations are pretty high that you are going to be serving in communities and perhaps even in leadership. Tell us what you're thinking about. How does this, both this expectation of yourselves and maybe others, kind of playing into how you're thinking about your own careers? I'd be curious.
I mean, I can only speak for myself in the sense that, honestly, I feel like I'm relishing the opportunity. It actually brings me a kind of calm and peace of mind that I'm able to kind of serve others while I'm training, and I feel like it, in some ways, is paying back the opportunity to go to medical school in the first place. So I think the opportunity to lead and to lead through serving others is something that I really, really wanted to continue to pursue. And so in a lot of ways, I would say I relish that opportunity, and it gives me a sense of ease and calm.
Thanks, Thomas. What about you, Kyle?
Since being here, it's been absolutely amazing, and you're exactly right. Like, we are expected to be leaders in this program, and as the firsts, as we're called, I know that we're going to be expected to foster the next group of firsts that are going to be coming in, and that not only that, but at North or near the end of our career, we're also going to be expected to bring in prospective medical students as well into our practices to train them and to also get high school students and college students interested in going to medical school, of people who are coming from rural communities, because that's who we need.
So what are you thinking about in terms of career? Have you started thinking about it?
Right now, I could see myself at least for the 3 years of service working in a center like Piedmont Health Services. A community health center. Mm-hmm. And at least not one-on-one. I would like to at least have another physician or provider there with me as I start to get off of my training wheels a little bit more and more. But and then after that, maybe going independently in a rural community outside of the health center.
What about you?
As accelerated as the program is, I think it's all of us, we have great conversations together, and I think all of us realize that there's still a lot more to see, and I'm not exactly sure where I'm going to be, but I know that serving an underserved population is something I want to do, possibly a health center, but definitely somewhere where there's a great need for medical care.
And then, Aaron, if you could leave our listeners perhaps with, you know, a final thought about how do you see these sorts of programs evolving? Because I imagine they do need to evolve, and you're kind of almost an interplay between at the program and ultimately the policies that get put into place that sustain and these types of programs. Help us see what the next 3, 4, 5, 6 years may be about. If we were to come back and talk about this 6 years from now, what would the conversation be like?
think that's a great question. I think 6 years from now, we're going to be looking at where you all are and who you're practicing with, and we'll have new cohorts coming in. And so we'll have some data to be able to show really this issue that you've brought up of service while you're training. And I think that we'll be able to use data to be able to talk about the contributions that you're making to the state. I'm a researcher. I use data to shape policy, and I think we'll be able to really show the value and importance and real contributions, not just in terms of data, but in terms of patient stories and in terms of access, that will be incredibly important. And I think then we can use those stories and those data to perhaps leverage new resources to be able to expand this program, either to make it larger for primary care or to expand it perhaps into other specialties like general surgery, or how about psychiatry? We have a critical shortage of psychiatrists in this state. We could be looking at having targeted investments to be able to link medical school with residencies in psychiatry. We sometimes have trouble matching folks into psychiatry residencies, but perhaps this would be a way of addressing that issue. So, Adam, I could see that this program really could allow us the opportunity to be able to show the value to other specialties and to make it higher and bigger scale.
It could be first, second, and third.
Third, I like it.
I'll tell you what, from having worked together as a team with all the community partners to bring this to fruition, and then to have you guys here speaking so passionately about your experiences and about the need for you, Dr. Frayer, it just brings me such joy and pride, and I'm just thrilled that we're going forward and that you're with us today.
And Christy, we should once again thank you. I think this program and nurturing it, and to see the children growing up, must be incredibly gratifying.
Pretty amazing. We didn't mean to put you guys down. You're grown men. we've been talking with these grown men, almost second year medical students, Kyle Melvin, Thane Campbell, and Thomas D'Angelo, the first students from the UNC FIRST program, and Dr. Aaron Frayer, about this program and acceleration to service in North Carolina. Thanks to all of you for being with us today.
Thank you so much.
Coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Stay with us.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, Adam and I get to spend a few minutes talking about your health questions and your concerns.
And if you have a question you'd like us to address, send it to yourhealth@unc.edu. And we'd like to ask our great executive producer, Daniel Lane, to read us our very first House Call question today about a upcoming college graduate and some of their concerns about health.
I'm a 22-year-old female and recent college graduate, and I will soon have to get my own insurance to replace what I have through school. I need to be conscious about my budget, and I'm wondering what sorts of medical things I should want coverage for and what sorts of things I may not need.
Well, this is an excellent question and one that's facing lots of people at all ages. And at your age, I think it's important to think about a few things. Some of the things that come to mind for me are making sure your prevention is covered, that you could get a physical or a general preventive visit from a doctor and be able to have those elements covered, your flu shot and that type of thing. The other thing that comes to mind is emergency insurance for catastrophe, and then prenatal and OB care. And I say this just because you're at an age where you could become pregnant. And if you do, it sounds like maybe you're not planning that, but I would advise you to really think that through if you were considering not having that kind of coverage.
One of the things I think Christy and I would both agree on is don't go without coverage.
Yeah.
And that could be a common mistake that some people make, is to think, oh, I don't need it. I'm pretty healthy. You also can, in most cases, in most states under the Affordable Care Act, you can get coverage under till 25 extended through parents. So you might want to actually talk with and see if that's an option. We have our son still in our policy, at least until next February. And so these are some options. And then within the marketplace of available options, you may want to get either a medical savings account or one of these plans that has very high deductible, because really what you are covering yourself for is sometimes the things that could be really bad, and you are pretty healthy. So as long as you get the preventive benefits and get your annual things that you might need, maybe birth control pills if you're sexually active, you know, something like that, that would cover you there. These are not simple questions. Sometimes getting a consultation, but comparing plan A to plan B to plan C, take your time, make a good choice.
Good advice, Adam.
Thank you, Christy.
Okay, Daniel, let's take our next house call question.
We recently discovered that my 5-year-old son has a severe nut allergy for which our doctor recommended that he keep an EpiPen. We're worried, however, that he might be a little too young to have that responsibility. It's fine when we are with him and we can keep it, but it's when he goes to activities or to a friend's house that we're a little worried that something could happen if he plays with it. Do you have an opinion?
Well, we have opinions.
Oh, yeah.
That's never been a problem. But the question is, this is a serious issue that has lots of ramifications for you, your family, and your friends' families.
You know, most a lot of people, a common practice in this type of scenario is to, you know, to have separate kits, but to have a kit where you have that you bring to a friend's house that you go over with the parents. We've had multiple slumber parties where a mother has brought those over to us. I mean, thankfully, they're bringing them to a two-doctor family home and we know a little bit of something. But still, we go through everything on there about what to do and when. And that then allows shared responsibility from the adults in the home. I think at 5 years old, it's a lot to expect him to completely be able to navigate that by himself.
And I also think it puts a lot of responsibility on your friends.
It does.
The parents, his friends' parents.
Sure.
And because you're really having them take full responsibility, you know, we've always served peanut butter in our family because, first off, all of our kids love it and no one's allergic to it. And so to then say that, well, we need to put away not only that, but we might have to get rid of anything that has nuts and pans,
right.
It's difficult. So, yeah, but it has to have that conversation. So I think you need to find out who can do what needs to be done. I would also talk with an allergist because we do know that potentially exposing earlier now in life to small amounts of allergens like peanuts can actually lessen the chance of significant peanut allergy later in life. This is not an easy, straightforward. Let your doctor help you with this.
Absolutely. We wish you all the best. Thank you for sharing this tricky situation. We'd love to hear back from you, you know, after another several months or years on how you ended up handling it and how it went. We wish you the best. Let's take our next house call question.
My aunt is mentally challenged and is reaching the age where she might be near the end of her life. I'm her healthcare proxy, and I'm struggling with how I can possibly make end-of-life decisions for her. It's hard to decide when to withhold care or when to administer invasive care since I don't know what she might want, and she would not understand if I tried to explain it to her, and I'm worried about causing her harm. Do you have any guidance for this type of situation?
This is a really complicated one.
We could spend a whole show on this.
Oh, well, we have, and we will, I'm sure, spend more time on this. This is very difficult, especially if you don't feel like you know her values at this point and where she doesn't have the mental ability to share those with you. I'd encourage you to reach out to other family members who do know her values. If there are other people who could weigh in to sort of think through, what would she want? What did she care about? Was it pain? You know, do we want to focus on relieving pain? Or making some of those decisions, and also have her primary doctor, who may have known her for some time, kind of work through some of these questions and forms with you to make those decisions.
I do like the way you phrased causing her harm as an ethical framework to consider.
Mm-hmm.
You didn't say quality of life, which I sometimes find very treacherous to say, oh, she doesn't have quality of life with someone who's got advancing dementia. That's a really difficult thing. But causing harm, well, we could all say if someone's causing someone harm, we might want to withhold some things, and particularly the invasive procedures that potentially cause more harm than good. So I think balancing that, you got a good start. You're on the right path. Love your idea, Christy. Talk with other family members. Talk with your doctors, too, because they may have some thoughts. Ultimately, it sounds like it's your decision.
Well, thank you for that very complicated question and for all of our questions today. We are grateful you've joined us today for your health, and we hope we've addressed some issues and concerns that are important to you in your health. Share your questions, share your stories, email us at yourhealth@unc.edu. You can visit us online at yourhealthradio.org, follow us on Twitter, Facebook, iTunes, or get our health app. Just search one word, Your Health, for a free download.
We'd like to thank the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare, for their sponsorship, and our great guests today, Dr. Aaron Frayer, Thomas D'Angelo, Kyle Melvin, and Thane Campbell. We hope you'll join us next time on Your Health.
On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein, and we look forward to talking with you again next week. Bye-bye.
Take care.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine.